is a nonprofit in Chicago that works at the kind of crossroads of activism and art, social practice. And so I know people that are part of Deep Time, but I was kind of invited in for this chapter. But I'm not part of the Deep Time Collective.
Yep. What's your name?
Jennifer Scapitone.
It's combustion.
Maybe if I forget that, I can ask you because it's now been recorded.
I did. I just paused it, actually.
Okay. Hearts Abustin. That is such an American name. It's so slangy.
It's the pad bust. And it looks like a heart.
Okay, so I'm Jennifer Scapitone. I am a professor at the University of Chicago, and I teach literature, urbanism.
This would have been painted. So it's kind of disappointing to share with you is if you had come maybe 5 years ago, this would look way more impressive. So some of these cane brake stands were probably 3 feet taller than I was and would go all the way back. You can see remnants of it in the back there. So this is a native bamboo species. So when they flower,
crazy,
that adult plant will die and seed out. And so the seedlings haven't had a chance to grow and flourish. And when they do seed like that, they're food for endangered animals or state-threatened animals like golden mice, okay, and other rodents. Birds will feed on the seeds as well. They have a lifespan of about 10 years, to 20 years. It just depends. They don't always also do that one mass flowering at the end, but it did happen just a few years ago in the cache. We'll get to the cambrics then, as well if you want to read a little bit more of information about these. But in the best historically, this canebrake habitat would have supported wood bison when they would seasonally migrate. That's what they would graze on. It would also support black bear. And then for nesting warblers, that habitat is really important because it's really hard to penetrate some of these cane thickets. So one of the state-threatened warblers that you could find in the cache are the Swainson's warblers.
Okay. So Professor Bitsch.
Okay. So I teach modern and contemporary literature in relation to urbanism and architectural history and environmental humanities. I'm also a poet, and I teach poetry and translation at the University of Chicago, which is a very interdisciplinary place. So if that sounds like a lot, it's kind of more typical of there than of some other universities.
Okay, and so are you still involved in this work that you're doing around your hometown?
Yes. So the work surrounded a dump. I would hesitate to call it a landfill because it wasn't properly engineered, but it's known as the Syosset Landfill, and it was listed as a national priority by the Environmental Protection Agency in 1981.
I'll just pause it.
Okay, we've all been we're very much in the dark about what the future itinerary is.
I am as well. I don't know if it's deliberate or... No.
I think it probably is somewhat deliberate, but I don't mind not doing this if it's the best time to talk about it, because it would be cool if there were someone, you know, maybe it would help jumpstart something if you wrote about it. Otherwise, we can just do it on a more... There have been so many moments of, like, dilated non-activity when we could talk about this. Are you doing the whole trip today?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, we could do it on the bus.
I'm not,
oh, no,
on
I'm
the
not
bus.
Getting back on the bus. I'm going in a car.
Yeah, I'm going in a car too. So we could, if it seems like it's not going to be obnoxious, we could talk about it a little here during this moment.
Yeah, that's okay with you.
Okay.
I won't be able to talk to have it for that long, so I've got so much media at the moment. I'm going to struggle to edit it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
So even if it's just we could take like 5 minutes, we can maybe walk to a place where there are fewer of us, so we're not disturbing them.
Yeah. Okay.
That's my partner up there, so he'll understand. Okay. So,
you were telling me about the dump stroke.
Okay. Okay, so.
And if you can, just for the sake of, like, I don't know, condensing the interview, try and think about, it would be nice to start thinking about this in more abstract, like, aggregated terms, as well as the localized ones. So, in terms of the collective. Because you're the only person that I've met thinking about this so far.
Okay, all right. So let me kind of rephrase the question to myself. So basically, right now I'm working on a project that's both, it's a writerly poetic project, but it's essentially an environmental justice project that opens out from a Superfund listed landfill that I grew up across the street from, and the adjacent copper rod mill, which was listed as an inactive hazardous waste site at the beginning of the 1980s, and which continues to be a site of contestation, both for reasons of environmental damage, but also for just debate about what uses this site should be put to. I did approximately 10 years of research toward a book called The Republic of Exit 43, Outtakes and Scores from an Archaeology and Pop-Up Opera of the Corporate Dump for Atilos Press, about the frustration of any individual from that neighborhood's attempt to understand what had happened at the site, which is significant because the site had been identified as a national priority, therefore is one of the most toxic sites in the United States, eligible for cleanup through this fund called a Superfund of money. The fund has been gradually decreased, of course, as has the ability of the courts and of the Environmental Protection Agency to chase after corporations that are responsible for environmental damage. So over the course of mostly Republican administrations, these protections for citizens have gradually been weakened. My book, I'm a poet as well as a scholar, so my book was really aimed at reflecting the affective and cognitive dissonance and the sort of anarchy of the person who wants to know simply what has happened and what the health implications are of having dumped many toxic substances into a landfill that also adjoined an elementary school. But after having published that book, and while I'm in the midst of a sort of second book in a diptych project, I've begun to go on the road with this project and present it in places like Detroit, or talk to people in New Orleans, or even in Davis, California, basically many different sites. And what I find is that there are many communities that have concerned citizens in them, and I'm starting to hear the same kinds of frustrations from these other people who were victims of environmental injustice. And what I'm wondering is whether there exists, or whether there can be built, a grassroots network of concerned citizens on a national level or an international level. because we do have the Environmental Protection Agency in the United States, and this is a value. Part of the reason why I'm still working on this is because I learned where the copper was extracted for the copper rod mill that was next to the dump across the street from my childhood home. And I learned that it came from the Peruvian Andes, and the community there, which is dealing with an open pit mine and a smelter, is much more vulnerable because these issues are not being addressed, even having been reported on globally. They're not being addressed with sufficiency. So in a situation in which we have supposedly an agency devoted to environmental protection, there are still many, many shortcomings to that system, among which is outreach between the agency and citizens who are impacted. The lack of true participatory possibilities for conversations about what has occurred, how to mitigate the impacts, and let alone talk of reparations or discussion of actually moving people away, or, you know, changing the site of the elementary school, which was never done in this case. It was simply shut down while they installed a plastic cap over the landfill. So that's what I've been thinking about over the course of the past couple of years. My book on the landfill and the issue of landfills and salvage came out in late 2016. It was in press during the elections of 2016. And it was intended as an expression of outrage and against the incapacity of the Environmental Protection Agency to truly protect its citizens. And since publication, it has been weakened to such a degree that the very title is inadequate. It should be the Environmental Destruction Agency. So now more than ever, we need grassroots networks of people who can share resources, who can understand together how to do testing in their neighborhoods, who can find people with authority to fight against the lawyers, for instance, of corporations. Corporate interests hold the day in the present U.S., but not only, I'm afraid. It seems very clear that transnationally, corporate interests hold the day by default, unless there are really radical upswellings of people that are being reported on, that get enough media attention, and where some politician would be compromised if they didn't do anything about it.
Wow, thank you. That's a really thorough overview. There was something that you said to me about, or you said to Rosemary, actually, about what you've seen as those three kind of vested interests that you've sort of spotted as a pattern. That here, one of them was real estate value, mm-hmm. but there's three kind of reasons that you keep seeing as shaping the way that things can or can't move. I can't remember what the other
yes.
two were.
Yes. So in that case, she had asked me why I thought it was the case that, as I mentioned, the community impacted doesn't appear to be interested in rallying around this issue. The primary reason, I think, is fear and dread. So they know that there's a cancer cluster, and they know it has something to do with the copper rod mill and the dump, but they don't precisely know. They certainly haven't read the Environmental Protection Agency documents, and they don't seem interested in learning more from a person who's produced a book of poetry, but which has a bibliography at the end of sources that they can look to. The second is, the one that I think is the most impactful is actually a concern for the loss of their property value. This is I happen to grow up on what's called the Gold Coast of public education, so in a pretty good public school district. And I grew up on the cheap post-industrial edge of it. So it was an opportunity for mostly immigrant families to somehow sneak their way into an adequate public school district. And that was one of the things that interested me in writing the book too, was that I could get a great schooling, but it would be at the expense of my health and my family's health. What was the third thing that I was thinking? It was fear. Oh, ignorance is the third. I think it's ignorance, and I don't think it's a special kind of ignorance. I just think that Americans in general are taught hero narratives in which they think that they can somehow make it individually if they do the right things in life. So if they get enough sleep and they eat the right foods and they exercise, etc., etc., that kind of narrative about health prevails over being unwittingly poisoned. Of course, people are worried about being poisoned, but they don't have the resources really in the neighborhood in which I grew up. It's not a university town. It's just a kind of bedroom community from New York City that once was farmland and then was industrialized and then became kind of a suburb of a very classic Levittown style development. So I think they don't even have the resources to imagine how they would think anything other than the state is protecting them and corporations would never be allowed to get away with anything if it were really that harmful. Instead, they think that regulating businesses, and I think this would be true of my town, they would think that over-regulating businesses leads to economic downturns and hurts growth. So it's a classic novel of Trump's America, a classic kind of motto that too big a government will stymie economic development. And there are many business-minded people in that part of the country for whom that would prevail. And they don't have the resources, again, to even understand the extent of the environmental damage. And if it's been done already and they've already been exposed, they have no idea what to do about it. So they just sort of let the cloud of dread around the cancer cluster hover. And they're basically at an impasse.
Wow. Like a lot of things too, really, because that occurred to me, some of the weird things that we encountered in Louisiana in around Reserve in St. John's Parish and the Cancer Alley thing, just west of New Orleans, was this strange dissonance between, there seemed to be intact unions that were working in the plants that were yes. polluting the communities, but the unions were turning away from what they could actually see in front of their eyes in support of the firms that they were working for.
Right.
And then this kind of, we encountered the vice president of Shintech, who produced, I think, the most PVC of any plant in the United States. They export most of the United States. PVC is powder. So plastic plants. And he gave us this really heartfelt story in which he actually cried during this presentation he gave to the Louisiana Environmental Network that had coordinated the visit. So they maintain relationships with people and then take people in, and it's a strange kind of precarious arrangement, I guess. And he just talked about how all his cousins and his family members had basically dropped out of society, were struggling with drug addictions, felonies, incarceration, and that was probably would have been his fate too, unless he'd been given this opportunity to kind of work up through the ranks of this company. And that's what he likes to do with local people, and he has all these employment things, and that's the narrative, and you can see how potent it is. And
right.
then you go and meet the communities who are suffering if these things describe themselves as ragdolls, because they've had so many tumours cut out of their bodies and their children are dying. And it's the high, I think it's 700 times the baseline level of cancer incidences there. But I couldn't understand I was trying to understand what it meant to live in such economic deprivation mm-hmm. over a long period of time, that's actually in some ways a rational choice to make for lots of people, and you know that reconciles the dissonance. But I'm so
right.
interested in this and how deeply that economic fear, I think, has mm. penetrated the psyches of people, that it comes before the immediate healthcare needs. And you can see it, I mean, it's like smoking, or like even studies like why do people in sub-Saharan Africa still, knowing risks around what transmits HIV/AIDS, or this is a bit of a random analysis comparison, but they did a study of truck drivers in a country in sub-Saharan Africa who had such a fatalistic attitude toward life that they didn't practice anything that would protect them from HIV/AIDS, and they had such a high incidence of AIDS,
mm.
and it's because they had such a high fatalist. And I don't know, I'm just thinking through all these things,
right.
trying to make sense of.
I think, okay, so I've also written a book called Killing the Moonlight, Modernism in Venice, which was about a range of issues surrounding Venice as a fabled outside to modernity. But one of the issues that I brought out toward the end of the research, but at the it comes out in the introduction to the book, is about the petrochemical plants of Marghera. And I just touch on it very quickly, but it's a standing interest. The fact that there were really outrageous labor conditions in the petrochemical plants at Marghera, and no one was punished for them in the corporation at fault. And there were many working people who fought to, you know, keep those working opportunities alive. And it could really be said that, of course, like shutting down the industry at Marghera has contributed to the evacuation of Venice as a city, and has contributed to its becoming a kind of tourist Disneyland. So those are real concerns. And when people aren't armed with enough information to understand the health damage, and instead, particularly in the United States, instead they worry about whether they'll be able to pay their hospital bills if they don't have a job, because we don't have socialized medicine. It's not as straightforward as you would think from a socialist country's point of view. In order to have healthcare and to be able to pay for your own healthcare, you need to have a job. So when your job is predicated on being complicit, then people are driven by that fear, and the fear of economic precarity and being out on the street or not being able to provide for their families. So that's a real issue. The curious thing about my neighborhood is that it was post-industrial, so people were no longer being employed by those places. So it's a little bit curious that I feel like I've gotten little traction at the local level. Although also I've been more interested in the national and international implications of the state of ignorance in which people are kept, and in more abstract mechanisms, that I haven't focused all my energies along the lines of a concerned citizens of Syosset group, the way the people that presented yesterday were. But I really, as an educator, I'm trying to, and as a writer, I'm trying to increase awareness of the ubiquity of these situations and connect people with the resources that would make it possible for them to know about, say, Clean Water Act violations or violations that aren't being gone after by the Environmental Protection Agency, either because of understaffing or because of corruption. That's just to name one example. Another example would be something that came up in our earlier conversation about how there's a boundary line drawn around toxic sites that are treated, and right adjacent to that line, it's as if there are no health implications, and concerned citizens have no way of, rebuking whatever the scientist, or they have little way of rebuking what a scientist hired by the Environmental Protection Agency, who might be in the thrall of a corporation, might have to say about, oh, well, we know that it's fine over that line. And it seems pretty clear that it isn't fine for any number of reasons, because we know that borders are permeable on any number of levels in the water, soil, and air, and that the very idea of drawing a boundary around it is ludicrous conceptually. But that's not how people think. People continue to believe in boundaries for many, many reasons, because of fear primarily, but also for other reasons, economic and otherwise.
Bureaucracy and management and, needing to draw lines. I mean, it's like the story of America, isn't it? Drawing lines around bits of land and all out.
It's enclosure to the present,
Yeah. Oh gosh. And so tell me a little bit about what you see. Do you have any thoughts? Should we move?
Yeah, I don't know where they are. So
about what you think strategically could happen in terms of joining up.
Right. So I admit that I, have a full-time job at a university, and I also am a practicing artist, and I was so head deep, if that's a term, in the research for what had gone on in my neighborhood that I didn't have any idea of how to connect with others that had gone through the same thing, and it was purely sort of circumstantial when I did at a conference or at a reading of mine. And so it may be that I've done insufficient research to identify environmental justice groups who are working beyond the immediate regional level. But I tend to find that a lot of NGOs are, their work is more solutions-based, so how to clean up a certain area, or how to provide better practices for, let's say, like artisanal mining communities, something like that, because they can deliver very lucid results and improvements that way. But it doesn't seem as easy to identify people that are working to increase awareness in general of the resources that might be available to them as concerned citizens in places where there's just gossip around the cancer cluster and not much more, or people know that they've grown up next to an industrial site, but it hasn't been identified by the EPA, or it has, but they're concerned that they didn't go far enough. So that's what it's occurring to me more and more that it would be important for me to do additional research on that front. And if it doesn't exist, then to start building it, to build this kind of network of grassroots, but like very wide-ranging environmental justice advocacy.
So, yeah, sounds like it's really needed. I mean, I just can't believe it doesn't exist if it doesn't.
It's not clear.
No.
It's not clear that it exists. So I don't want to say it doesn't exist, and I'm kind of embarrassed that I can't say with certainty. But again, the plight of a person who's trying to understand why their mother has cancer while they're supporting them through chemotherapy or something is that they don't have the capacity to seek out other activist groups at that point, oftentimes.
It makes me so curious to know. I mean, so my research background is kind of doing institutional ethnographies, following policymakers and ecologists around as much as I can to understand the very textured interactions that produce various different policy.
Oh, wow. You're the perfect person to talk to.
And it just makes me think about what kind of bureaucratic, institutional and legal mechanisms have become established in the UPA to manage this, because it must be taking up a portion of their resources, let you say.
Right.
And I'm just, yeah, so there must be people, you know, you could do either straightforward academic research, investigative research, or I don't know what, speaking to people that used to work there, or just trying to better understand how it all fits together.
I've understood a little bit more recently due to having my interactions with a colleague at the University of Chicago Environmental Law Clinic, which works on behalf of citizens who want to bring a case against someone like U.S. Steel for their exceedances that have gone unregulated of the Clean Water Act. And I got to understand much more through this lawyer how to go about it. Thank you. Cool.
Lunch. Must have written about this in certain, in different disciplines.
Right.
In environmental studies or political ecology or something.
Right. Mm-hmm. Something that, I mean, one thing I say is that I was always interested in environmental studies, but I fell into this project by way of my mother's cancer. So I was not like someone who went to school in environmental humanities. That didn't even exist then, but when I went to get my PhD, I don't think environmental studies existed. But it's sort of like, I'm also interested in how people fall into things that they just need to work on for their own survival or to satisfy their own fear or craving for information. And so there probably is. So I'm kind of going through the back door. My disciplinary formation is literature and art and architectural history. And I'm getting into these other issues through the back door. So I'm sort of slow to know about them, you know, like who has written about citizen organizing and, you know, on an academic level. So I'm kind of a curious person because I do have academic credentials and I work at a university.
Everybody!
But this is everybody not the way that I approached this particular project.
To make the magic happen, you now have to begin leaving. So that means just what it says.
Jennifer, thank you.
Thank you, Louise. Maybe we can exchange contacts.